clock. Up to Date is next.
I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Liberal is a word we hear a lot without considering what it really means. Some on the right use it with contempt, like a bludgeon against an enemy. For some on the left, the term rings hollow. So where have things gone wrong, and is it too late to fix it? Today, The New Yorker's Adam Gopnik explains why Americans aren't connecting with liberalism. Then, when Harry Truman said he felt the whole weight of the moon and stars fell on me, he wasn't kidding. The 33rd president took office accidentally and had a fateful time. We'll hear how his first months in office changed the world. Later, Brian McTavish presents the Weekend To-Do List. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Critic and thinker Adam Gopnik muses about all kinds of things: the meaning of liberalism, New York City is home, the precariousness of our society. He does this most notably in essays in The New Yorker and in lectures and in a new book just out, At the Stranger's Gate, which chronicled he and his wife's decision to leave the comforts of home in Montreal for New York City. Gopnik has won 3 National Magazine Awards for essays and for criticism, and also the George Polk Award for magazine reporting. He's in town today to give a cockafair lecture at UMKC this evening. More on that in just a few moments. And he joins us right now. And Adam, welcome. So good to have you here.
Wonderful to be back in Kansas City.
I'm just wondering, you write about so many things. How are you faring yourself in the age of Trump?
Not so well.
Not so well.
Not so well.
A little rough?
Well, I mean, well, in one sense. You know, a writer has an obligation, I think, both as an artist, you're trying to make beautiful things, and as a citizen, you're trying to say true things. And certainly the era of Trump has been a call to citizenship on the part of every writer in America.
And things to write about.
And things to write about. You know, it's not a boring time, certainly. It's not a time of withdrawal where you say, you know, I want to write about domestic trivia because I don't think that there's anything significant to write about in the public arena. So in that sense, it's been a breath for me because I'm not by nature a pundit, haven't written a lot of punditry in my life, and yet I find myself writing political comment 2 or 3 times a week now. I don't think I'm unique in that. I think a lot of people feel that way. The other thing that's positive in a perverse way is that it's clarifying. What's at stake seems very much clearer now than it might have seemed 3 or 4 years ago.
That's interesting.
I'm old enough to remember, you know, right around the turn of the millennium, around 2000, there were a lot of people who were saying, well, politics is more or less decided now. You remember that end of history?
Mm-hmm.
A little theme that came out. Politics is decided. The real vigor will be in culture and in technology and so on. And now we find out that if you're not interested in politics, politics is interested in you. And there's fundamental challenges, not just in America, but around the world now, to what we used to call the liberal order. And that's what I'm going to be talking about tonight.
Yes.
It's what I'm thinking about all the time. What is that liberal order? What's the challenge? Is it worth renewing? And if it is, how do we renew it?
Yeah, we'll talk about that. I mean, do you find yourself unsettled just in your own life, Adam, by what you're seeing coming out of Washington?
Of course. You know, on the night of the election a year ago, my daughter, who was 17 then, Olivia, was one of, I think, a generation of girls who were profoundly traumatized by what was happening. Not just because they might have been supporting Hillary Clinton, though they were, but something that seemed to them out of the set of expectations that they thought were possible in the world had happened. And I put my arm around her, and we walked round and round and round our block in New York, and I tried to talk sense to her about politics in a fundamental way. You know, I remember saying to her, baby, Barack Obama did not cut your sandwiches every morning. You know, it's not the president who makes meaning for us. We make meaning, and then that gets transferred upwards to politics. So we have a job of making meaning for the next year. I'm very proud of her. She's been doing that. She's been an activist.
Can you be an optimist at a time like this?
It's a big question.
Yeah.
You know, you can never be an optimist about life because life is fatal. Life is fatal going in, right? And everything ends. But I do think that along with 2 things have happened, I think, in the past year. One is that we've seen alarming signs of a new autocracy, new authoritarianism. At the same time, we've seen very encouraging signs of how rich and resilient what we call the civil society of America mm-hmm. is. I don't just mean by civil society, political parties. That's the least of it. I'm impressed by the way that comedians feel a call to action. When Jimmy Kimmel yeah. is leading a political movement, you know, there's some life in it. When swimsuit models, you know, are taking the lead, that then you feel that there's a lot more life and resilience and resistance in American civil society than we might have anticipated.
You know, you're a critic, Adam. You're a commentator. What do you see as your role at a time like this?
It's all part of the role of a writer. A writer's job is to bear witness. A writer's job is not to change minds. You wish you could, but I have no illusions about how many minds I'm going to change writing in the pages or on the pixels of the New Yorker. A writer's job is not to persuade people necessarily. We can't do that. But it is the fundamental job every writer has in every sphere that we write to bear witness.
Why can't you persuade people?
Well, you try to, but you mm-hmm. don't want to go in with the belief that you're going to because, mm-hmm. you know, that's hard to do. People don't tend to get persuaded. Very rarely in life do we read something and say, I was wrong and he was right and now I'm going to vote for Mr. A instead of Mrs. B. What happens more often is that you can give arguments and you can give a tone to your own side. You can tell people on your own side by the tone you use. You can say, let's not be hysterical. Let's be rational. Let's insist on the primacy of reason and evidence in the way we argue. And that will give us a certain, I don't know what to call it, a certain elan, a certain authority that we might not have otherwise. But I don't have illusions about persuading people, but I do have faith that we need voices. We want to hear, you know, think about how grateful you are when you read something that you agree with and you say, that's well said, whether it's, I don't know who it might be. It could be Albert Camus or it could be George Will. But you say, that's well said. And you feel a certain sense of reassurance about the possibilities of cognition, in a way, and articulation when you read that.
Adam Gopnik is my guest. He'll be giving a Cockafair lecture this evening at UMKC at 6:30 at Pearson Auditorium on campus. The event is free, but a reservation is required through the central ticket office. Adam's latest book, At the Stranger's Gate. You know, I just watched on YouTube a talk you gave earlier this year, Adam, about liberalism, which you referred to here. And you began that talk with this unnerving idea about what you think about late at night, which is how quickly that societies can unravel. You called it sudden overturnings. You mentioned a couple of examples, World War I and the market crash of 2008 you referred to. You know, we walk through our lives, I think, believing that we're, I think most of us, that we're invulnerable to sudden overturnings, even though we experienced a near miss not all that long ago. But you suggest we're not at all that invulnerable to anything like this, and I'm wondering why.
Well, because you look at history. Because you look at 1913, when you had in Europe this extraordinarily prosperous and largely peaceful society that had been generating more riches than any society before, inequitable in lots of ways, deeply flawed in many ways, but still a society. And the last thing you would think that society would do is commit suicide.
And it blew up in a flash.
And in a flash. In 1914, European civilization committed suicide, and it would be a century before it would begin to return to the level of prosperity, let alone a social peace that had happened before. I think this is a far-reaching one. But I gave a lecture about Jerusalem in the year 1000. And around 900, Jerusalem was a place where three civilizations, Muslim, Jewish, and Christian, all coexisted more or less equitably. 100 years later, massacre, counter-massacre, and that basic social peace had been destroyed. So we live in a country where coexistence and general peaceful get-alongness has been going along for a pretty long time. And we believe nothing that horrible can happen to us.
Because we're a modern society. We're a sophisticated society. We're an intellectual society. It can't happen.
Exactly. And so we say, you know, people we disagree with are going to be in power, but that's part of the natural oscillation of power. We accept all that. But then suddenly you say, well, maybe not. Maybe we're living in a time when autocracy, maybe when Putinism is going to become the dominant ideology, seems to be sweeping through Europe.
It's not lost on me that you're writing this at a time when Donald Trump is president.
No, and of course, and you know, I don't want to narrow it down to being anti-Trump. I am anti-Trump, and vehemently and vigorously so. But it's not just Trump. It's a much larger moment that we're looking at. And what's at stake is beyond what even a Trump can destroy. And that is the basic premises of liberals. You know, you mentioned you're going to be talking about Harry Truman shortly.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking a lot about Truman. I'm going to start tonight's talk talking about Truman.
Wow. Yeah.
Because Truman is a great hero of that liberal society in a way that doesn't involve his being for identity politics or anything else. He was a man who believed in the rule of law and the primacy of reason.
Mm-hmm.
And whether we agree with everything he did or not, that's the kind of liberalism I'm talking about.
You know, some might argue that if we can withstand Trump, we can withstand anything.
Yeah. You know, the problem always is it's what comes after is usually worse. You know, there's a the thing about Trump, if I may say, is that you're always torn between your fear of his autocratic instincts and your laughter at his oafish incompetence in enforcing his autocratic instincts.
Mm-hmm.
And you're never quite sure if he's Mussolini or Ralph Cramden. You know, remember Ralph Cramden and the Honeymooners,
yes,
right?
Yes, I do.
The big blowhard who talks about, yeah. I'm sending you to the moon, Alice, and he just stands there. And that's one of the things that makes makes Trump a very strange character. I profoundly mistrust him, and of course I profoundly oppose him. But I think that we'd be making a mistake if we narrow it down to, oh, if we can vote Trump out, this problem will be solved. Because it's the same problem in Great Britain, same problem in France, the same problem in Eastern Europe.
You know, you mentioned liberalism a few minutes ago, Adam, and where it went wrong in the wake of last year's election. You talked about, in what you've written, an emptiness associated with liberalism. What do you mean by an emptiness associated with liberalism?
Right. That you put your finger exactly on where I think the problem is. An emptiness. Liberalism is terrific at creating prosperity. It's terrific at mostly having fair procedures. But human beings want a powerful sense of identity. They want a sense of belonging. And where I think, and this is what I'm going to say at the end tonight, where I think liberalism has gone wrong is that we've emphasized pluralism at the cost of patriotism.
Meaning what?
Meaning that we believe in fair play for everybody. We believe in inclusion. But we don't have, liberals don't have right now, a really convincing idea of patriotism that we can put up against the nationalism of someone like Trump. And mm-hmm. that's a huge loss. We need to be every bit as patriotic. We need to ostentatiously love America and have reasons for it as much as the other side does. Deprecating, putting down patriotism is the worst thing that liberals can do, in my view.
Yeah.
But the question is then, excuse me, how do you have a kind of patriotism that isn't just flag waving?
Yeah.
That isn't just flag waving.
A lot of folks say liberals don't have the fight in them that conservatives do. Why is that?
Well, it's the same reason, isn't it, right?
Because
we don't have, because liberalism is a plural philosophy, plural ideology. We believe that lots of competing views should be heard. We believe lots of competing kinds ought to be included in everything. So we're so concerned about making sure that all the kids in the kindergarten are getting an equal chance that we sometimes forget what we're teaching in the kindergarten. That's exactly the point. We need a liberalism that has spine, and we need a liberalism that has a plausible idea of loving your country.
The path ahead, you say, Adam, is to simply try again. And again, you've written that. But why else isn't liberalism connecting with the majority of Americans right now?
I think that liberalism often can seem like a fight for spoils among competing ethnic groups and identity groups. And that's never an appealing vision. But I think at core, it's that human beings, for good or ill, whether we like it or not, want an identity as citizens that is in large part irrational. We want to feel our heart flutter when the flag flutters. We want to feel connected. You know, that's why we love sports. I know we love sports because we feel connected to mm-hmm. the Montreal Canadiens or the Kansas City Chiefs, whoever it is. And those feelings of connection and belonging are vital to being human. Now, we want feelings of connection that can be as plural and inclusive as they possibly can be. But we can't pretend that that's not one of the goals of politics, is to supply a plausible idea of connection to people who might not otherwise feel that they're part of one common cause.
Adam Gopnik of The New Yorker fame is my guest here. Your new book, Adam, is At the Stranger's Gate, which chronicled you and your wife's decision to leave Montreal back in the 80s for New York City. Why did you want to leave, or why did you leave Montreal to begin with?
Well, we love Montreal, as I still do. I root for the Montreal teams, but it was a small town by comparison to New York.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a kind of wind in the world that picks up young men and women and says, get to the capital, you know, whether it's, you know, D'Artagnan and the Three Musketeers or us getting on a bus. It was as simple as that. I wanted to be a songwriter. I wanted to be a writer. And that seemed like the arena to do it. But above all, we kind of wanted to see the world. We wanted to, you know, to try the big town.
What did you make of it when you first got there? Because you write about ambition and greed taking over New York City at the time you arrived.
Well, we arrived and rented the smallest apartment in New York City, a single 9x11 basement room. So we were not exactly living high. But it's true that the New York of art and ideas of, you know, Gershwin and Jackson Pollock that I dreamt of going to was being replaced very much by the New York of Donald Trump and Jeff Koons, in New York that was
Bonfire of the Vanities.
Yes, by Bonfire of the Vanities, exactly.
Yeah.
And a Bonfire of the Pieties that went with it, all the things that we believed in, not just the vanities, not just the illusions, but all the things we believed in were burning up. So that's very much what the book is about. It's about, one part of it is a romantic comedy about a young couple starting out in life, and the other part of it is about a young couple being disillusioned by what they were seeing in the world around them.
You're still there?
We're still there. We spent several years in Paris. We ran off to Paris, and I have a warm place in my heart and in my publisher's bank account for writing about Paris. But New York is home, and I can't imagine, really imagine leaving it.
How has it changed in the years you've been there? It's moved past the greed and ambition stage?
Yeah, I think the way New York has changed most is unfortunately, is it becomes harder and harder for young people with stars in their eyes and a manuscript in their pockets to make a life there. New York has become much more homogenized than it was when we arrived. When we arrived, there were bohemian frontiers everywhere you looked. There were all these little worlds of artists making art, musicians making music, filmmakers making films. That gets harder and harder to do. We've just been plain priced out of the place. And I think that it's happened in many cities around the world, from San Francisco to Rome. But that business of young artists being priced out of the places where they want to make art is one that has a stultifying, even a strangling effect on creativity.
Huh. Out here in the heartland, we sometimes overlook New York, and I'm wondering how important is that city to this country?
Well, you know, my friend Bud Trillin, Calvin Trillin, a great Kansas Cityan.
Yeah, right, a great Kansas City.
Is always, you know, says that he wants to keep a bit of Kansas City. The theme he's always had for his kids is that you're growing up in Kansas City. And the theme I always have for my kids is you're growing up in Canada. And the great thing about New York is it can include all of those visions. It's such a large and enveloping city that you get a chance to make and build your own values, build your own meanings in a certain way, apart from whatever the majority is. You can't scandalize New York, even by being normal, and that's a very positive part of it.
How is the New Yorker faring these days in this age of people reading less and less?
Well, you know, we knock wood and fingers crossed, we seem to be doing okay. One of the consequences of the Trump era is that people are adhering to the institutions that they believe are accurate, fair, and intelligent, and I think we are one of the chief of those. So we're doing fine in terms of people reading us. We have to adjust to the age of the internet the way everybody does, and it's certainly changed my life. I used to write to 2- and 3-week deadlines, and now, truly, I write often to 2- and 3-hour deadlines.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Even at the New Yorker?
Even at the New Yorker, especially at the New Yorker. There's a gun massacre in California or in Nevada. The editor says, we need to say something about it, and you're our gun control guy, so say something. So I'm always, often writing. Now, I still write on 2- and 3-week deadlines for other kinds of things. I just have a long piece about Philip Roth, for instance, that I crafted slowly in the magazine. But I'm often on 2- and 3-hour deadlines, and we've had to make that transition along with every other institution of journalism in the country.
How does a guy like you manage that? And for what it's worth, I have no sympathy for you as a lifelong newspaper journalist, but how have you managed that?
I've loved it, to be perfectly honest
really?
With you. I should tell you,
adrenaline rush?
I love doing it. You know, it means that you have to, I'm a quick thinker, I think, and I'm a reasonably rapid writer, and it means you have much less space for the curlicues, the ornaments of literary expression, and the premium is on maximum of emotion and clarity. And I love having that as a task. It's changed my writing. I think
That's
people
great.
Who follow my writing will say, boy, you're writing with a certain kind of fire that you didn't have before. And I think that's true.
Adam Gopnik speaks this evening at 6:30 at Pearson Auditorium on the UMKC campus. He'll be giving a Cock Affair lecture. The event is free, but a reservation is required through the Central Ticket Office. Adam, what a pleasure to have you here. Enjoy your time in Kansas City.
It's been a joy being here. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Coming up, we'll talk about Harry S. Truman and his first 4 months of his presidency. Those months changed the world. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we spoke with the chief of the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department about the needs of his department and of our community. You can find that conversation at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we meet Vietnam vet John Musgrave. The Kansas man was featured in Ken Burns' PBS documentary about the Vietnam War. John Musgrave tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, when Harry Truman suddenly became president, enormous challenges awaited. There was the end of World War II to manage, the atom bomb, Germany, Japan, and truly, the fate of the world. No wonder Truman pointed out those first hours after FDR died that he felt the whole weight of the moon and stars falling on me. A.J. Baim has written a new account of Truman's first 4 months in the presidency in 1945. That book, The Accidental President, Harry S. Truman and the 4 Months That Changed the World. He's also the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Arsenal of Democracy, FDR, Detroit, and an Epic Quest to Arm an America at War. And he writes the My Right column for the Wall Street Journal. A.J.'s in town tonight. More on that in a minute. And so good to have you here. Welcome.
It's so great to be here. I appreciate it.
Thank How did you get to Harry Truman from the My Ride column in the Wall Street Journal?
Every book I've written, the last three books I've written, they all sort of fall out of the one before.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you hear that a lot when people like me are sitting in the seat.
Sure.
In my last book, The Arsenal of Democracy, there's a chapter where this guy named Harry Truman goes to investigate Ford Motor Company in 1942 and then again in 1943. And it struck me as just amazing how obscure this guy Truman was in 1943, understanding, of course, that soon after he's about to become the most powerful man in the history of the world by accident. And those are his words, by accident.
Yeah. Let's talk about those minutes when he did become president, AJ. How did this fateful day of April 12, 1945 begin for Harry Truman?
The day began, let's see, I spent 38 pages on this one day. So the whole first 38 pages is everything that's happening in the world, particular in Harry's world and also in FDR's world on April 12th. So
yeah.
Truman is he's having lunch with his Kansas City buddy named McKim. He presides over the Senate. It's 4:57 p.m. The Senate adjourns and he goes to have a cocktail with Sam Rayburn, the Speaker of the House. And when he gets to the office, Sam Rayburn says, there's a call for you from the White House, Steve Early. Truman is handed his favorite drink, bourbon and water. He's holding the drink. He makes the call. He's told to go to the White House immediately and go through the front door, and he knows something's up. And he turns around and he says, Jesus Christ and General Jackson, something happened.
Yeah, absolutely. Reporters watching Truman in the Senate that day wondered, even at that moment, they didn't know he was about to become president, why FDR wasn't relying on him more. Why didn't FDR rely on him more?
In my opinion, and a lot of historians have said this, this was FDR's greatest mistake, not preparing as vice president. Because we all knew, or he knew, and all the people around him knew that he was having grave health problems. That was a mistake. And, I don't know why that happened. I can't get inside his head. I guess he thought he was invincible. But, so when he dies on April 12th, Harry is left with no understanding of what's going on in the White House, very little understanding of the global emergency. He really didn't even know FDR very well at all.
Why did Harry Truman even go to Sam Rayburn's office? Because it was known as the Board of Education, the office where Rayburn would often hold court.
They were going to have a drink.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the
bourbon
business—
Bourbon and water was Harry Truman's choice, right?
That's right. And a lot of the business of Congress went down— at lunches, when Harry came to Washington, said it's hard to find a dry lunch in this town.
Yeah.
These men would have drinks together and talk, Democrats, Republicans, and they would come together and figure out how to solve problems. So a lot of times Harry would go to the Board of Education, Sam Rayburn's office, after work to talk things over. It was a place where gossip was exchanged. When Sam Rayburn, the Speaker of the House, was asked why they call it
Board of Education.
The Board of Education. He said, well, I guess some guys have been educated down there.
A.J. Baim is my guest. His new book, The Accidental President, Harry S. Truman and the 4 Months That Changed the World. I was really struck by the fact that Truman arrives. He gets a bourbon and water handed to him. And it's only then that Rayburn tells him that this White House aide named Steve Early has called. Clearly, the Speaker of the House doesn't understand what's transpired here.
No, he doesn't know. And it's not really until Truman gets to the White House that he, you know, I think he suspects. He gets to the White House. An usher is there at the front door, takes his hat, and he's led upstairs to Eleanor Roosevelt's study on the second floor in the mansion. And that's when she tells him, she says, Harry, the president is dead.
And he tries to offer her his condolences.
It's such
and she offers him a quote that still rings in American presidential history. She said what to Harry Truman?
It's such a moving moment. He's, you know, Truman is looking at this woman whose husband just died, and he said, is there anything I can do for you? And she says, no, Harry, is there anything I can do for you are the one in trouble now.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Truman, as he left the speaker's office in the Capitol, I'm going back here a few minutes, he runs through the building, and his footsteps echoing off the walls there. It's raining outside. He flags down his driver. He gets a lift over to the White House. It was clear that Truman knew something was up. Do we know what he knew at that moment?
We don't. We know we had inklings, you know, that he had some idea of what was about to happen. Interesting, he left and he made that drive without Secret Service. So, you know, he was about to become the president of the United States. There was no Secret Service following him en route. And it's extraordinary that a man in his shoes, I mean, if I was a fiction writer, I couldn't make this up. It's just, it's so extraordinary, it's hard to believe that it's fact.
He was kept in the dark, as we've already talked about here. You know, he didn't even know about the atomic bomb being developed. How much in the dark was he?
Well, let's just talk for a moment as we lead up to that about how obscure he was. Let me give you two numbers.
Yeah.
Two numbers. One is, you know, Truman shocked the nation at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 1944. He goes to the convention. 2% of Americans, 2% of Democratic voters thought that Truman should be the vice presidential candidate. That's how obscure he was.
Yeah.
During the height of the 44 election, 55% of Americans, according to a Gallup poll, could even name FDR's running mate. That's how obscure Harry Truman was.
Mm-hmm.
So at the moment, you know, he becomes president, it's a shock to the nation in a way that I think it's very hard for people to understand today.
Why did FDR even pick him?
George Allen was head of the Democratic National Committee at the time, and he said in his memoirs that's a question that will be debated by historians forever, and no two accounts will ever be the same. So I have my account in the book. David McCullough in the Truman biography, of course, has his account. It's been written about many, many times, and no one can agree. So, but what we do know is that Truman was a compromise. So there are a lot of people much more well-known and much better prepared to be the vice president at that time, James Burns. But Burns had some, you know, problems in terms of the electorate. He had abandoned the Catholic Church, married a Protestant, so Catholics wouldn't vote for him. They were worried that African Americans would not vote if Burns was the vice presidential candidate because it came from South Carolina, from the South. That was a problem. And every candidate who was seemed to be more qualified than Truman had some problem. And Truman's biggest asset was he had no enemies. Hmm. And so he sort of, quote, fell into the slot.
You don't get the sense, again, from reading about this myself over the years, that FDR was really gave this a whole lot of thought or cared a whole lot. He was the guy. He was the leader of the free world, had been for a long time, and maybe he thought he was going to live forever.
I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, he had been president longer than any other man. He arguably was the first president to be thought of as one of the greatest American presidents during his administration. At the time, Americans were asked to name the most important figure in the world, and they named, in a poll, Roosevelt first, ahead of Abraham Lincoln and Jesus Christ.
Wow.
That's how respected, that's the stature of this man.
That's just amazing. So Truman, he gets to the White House, he has the conversation with Eleanor Roosevelt, then he takes the oath of office, and he told reporters at that moment how he felt. What did he say?
He said, I feel the moon and stars have fallen upon me. If newspaper men pray for me now.
Wow.
During that day, the first day of he was in office, he went back to his old, you know, he went back to see his friends in the Senate. And they started shaking his hands two at a time. He's reaching out and shaking hands two at a time. And someone says, calls him Mr. President. And he tears up and tears come out of his eyes because he can't believe that this has happened to him. And then when he walks out of the office, the newspaper men greet him. And I found this wonderful quote from Jack Bell, who was with the Associated Press at the time. He later said, you know, we couldn't bring ourselves to call him Mr. President. And yet we knew we were no longer supposed to call him Harry. So we just addressed him as you. And that's when he said this famous quote, I feel as if all the moon and stars have fallen on me. If newspaper men pray for me now.
How did Harry Truman handle those first few days?
They were obviously not easy, and I spent quite a bit of time on the book. I really try to put the reader in his shoes. So I spent a lot of time on April 13th and a lot of time on April 14th and walking in his footsteps and experiencing what he's experiencing. And he kept a diary. He wrote a lot of letters to his sister and his mother. So we know a lot. It's not that hard to get inside his head. And it's just this, to me, it was amazing to be able to write about this person because for me, and what I say in the book is there had never been a bigger underdog. And so as you're reading the book, you really find yourself, whether you're a Democrat, whether you're a Republican, whether you're alt-right, doesn't matter who you are, you can read this book and find yourself really rooting for this man.
A.J. Baim speaks at 6:30 this evening at the Unity Temple on the Plaza about his new book on our hometown president, the accidental president, Harry S. Truman, and the 4 months that changed the world. More information at rainydaybooks.com. Let's be clear here. This was the most ordinary of men. We've made this point here, who was taking over the most powerful job in the world. How else was he ordinary, AJ?
The way he dressed, the way he spoke. You know, the New Yorker, Adam Gopnik was here before me, right?
Yeah.
Had a wonderful quote just after Truman debuts on April 16th. So it's right after the funeral, and he gives a speech to Congress. It's a very moving moment. The nation's in shock. He gets up. He has to inspire confidence in the nation, in the allies overseas, and himself. And he looks up in the gallery, and he sees his wife is crying in the gallery. It's a very moving moment. The point I want to say here is the New Yorker had this wonderful quote after a writer said, Roosevelt was for the people. Harry Truman is the people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. Americans could really identify with this person. Newspapermen could identify that he had extraordinary ability to identify with your average person. And that really played to his credit.
Did the country rally around him?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
To read the press at the time, it's fascinating because you get the sense that people wanted this guy to succeed. And he had been so obscure before April 12th that there's this rush of media, and there's so much media produced about him. People wanted to know what he ate for lunch. They wanted to know what his wife was like, because she was a mystery too.
His wife, who was always so uncomfortable in the limelight, in the spotlight, and being the First Lady of the United States.
She agonized over whether or not to hold a press conference. She had never given a speech. She never wanted to give a speech. A year later, she was asked whether she would ever want her daughter to be a first lady, and she said absolutely not. She was asked if she liked being the first lady. She said absolutely not. She was asked if she ever thought—
You wouldn't say those things today.
No. Yeah. Well, this is the real answer. So she was asked if she thought there would ever be a female president, and she said absolutely not.
Huh.
Yeah.
And— you know, even today, you go out to the Truman home and you take a tour. I've talked about it here before. And you go into the dining room and the big table. And even when Harry was president, I think it was his mother-in-law who sat at the head of the table. And Harry Truman never was given that honor, even in his own family, given how his mother-in-law felt about him.
It's this famous part of the Truman, legend was his mother-in-law. Early in his life, his mother-in-law said, you don't want to marry that Harry guy, that farm boy.
Yes.
He's not going anywhere.
He's not going anywhere. And look
but
at him.
Even when she's in the White House, she still sort of looks down her nose at him. And I spend a lot of time in the book talking about these amazing things, this litany of historic events that happens in this 4 months. But at the same time, I do try to create the situation of what was it like to sit with the family at the dinner table in the White House, what was the family dynamic?
What was it?
Harry had never felt so distant from his wife. I think that was a problem. He was very worried about his daughter because suddenly his daughter, obviously the whole nation shut down when FDR died. His daughter writes, I have her diary. It's fascinating. I found it, obviously, in the Truman Library archives.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about what it's like to go back to school for the first day. She was at George Washington University. She goes back, and there's a whole crowd of photographers following her to her classroom. And the president was very upset about this. He was very upset about the fact that his newfound fame that he never really wanted was going to have on his wife, on his mother, on his sister, and on his daughter.
Hmm. You know, he faces all these tough decisions. You know, it's the founding of the UN, the fall of Berlin, the firebombings of Tokyo, AJ, not to mention the decision to drop the atomic bomb. What was the toughest decision he had to make during these 4 months that you chronicle here?
Without a doubt, obviously. I mean, the decision to use atomic weapons against human targets is without a doubt, 72 years later, if I'm doing my math correctly, still the most controversial decision that any president has ever had to make.
But he never regretted making it, though, from what I've read.
That's correct. That's mm-hmm. correct. And the book is certainly not about that decision because that book has been written many times.
Yeah.
But I do explore, you know, I have the documents that were available to him. We know what he was told and by whom. And in the end, I think it's pretty obvious that that decision was less hard to make, I think, than we would think now, because mm-hmm. we had this weapon. Japan was refusing to surrender.
The country had been at war for a lot of years.
A lot of years. We were planning an invasion of Japan that was going to put 766,700 American soldiers in harm's way. And we had seen what had happened in Okinawa and Iwo Jima. And we knew that bloodletting was going to be horrific.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bomb solved this problem and maybe solved other problems too.
Hmm. Why did you decide to focus on just 4 months?
I wanted to write about Truman, and this was the story. And nobody had written this story. And it's, you know, you've said it already, but it's just unimaginable all the things that happened during this 4 months. You know, the founding of the United Nations, the death of Hitler, the collapse of the Third Reich, firebombings of Tokyo, the first atomic explosion, nuclear destruction, and also the start of the Cold War and the beginning of the nuclear arms race. All that happened in 4 months. Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary.
What was his style of leadership, AJ? How would you describe it?
I'm actually going to be talking about exactly that tonight at this event. It's sponsored by the Truman Library. Thank you. The Truman Library Institute, I want to just shout and thank them.
Yeah.
Here, the answer to the question is this. This was a man who came to the White House with no preparation, little understanding of how things worked, not much understanding. He was very unprepared, obviously. But what he did have was these rural 19th century American principles. It was kind of like a human constitution that he had, like mm-hmm. the fabric of a man, you know, that he was taught by his mother. A man he might not have gone to college was educated in a certain way. Honesty is the best policy. Imagine that, you know, mm-hmm. honesty is the best policy. By golly, mm-hmm. you don't hear that today.
Mm-hmm. But he lived by that.
He lived by it.
Mm-hmm.
Make yourself useful. Lead by example. These were the sort of tools that he was going to use to navigate this impossible situation he was in. And in fact, we know it worked because 4 months in, his approval rating was 87%.
Yeah. Just to wrap this up, I mean, he obviously wins the election of 1948 against Tom Dewey, the great upset election. But by the time he leaves the presidency in 1953, he's unpopular. What happened?
Well, a lot happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let me try to sum this up real quickly. The Secretary of War, after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he used these words to describe that decision to do that. It was our, quote, least abhorrent choice.
Mm-hmm.
The Truman presidency was faced with crises left and right. And you had a president who was faced with making constantly the least abhorrent choice.
Right.
And so when he left office, he was not popular. But we have seen through the years, you know, there were two polls out recently that ranked Truman sixth, two of them, sixth all time. Among American presidents. Where does that come from again? It's the Constitution, and it's the human right. Constitution. It's the man.
A.J. Baim's new book on Harry Truman, The Accidental President, Harry S. Truman and the 4 Months That Changed the World. He speaks at 6:30 this evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza. More information, rainydaybooks.com. A.J., what a pleasure to have you here.
I really appreciate it. Good luck with the book. Thank you very much.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list.
The best. You can be the King Kong banging on your chest. You can beat the world. You can beat the war. You can talk the guy go banging on his door. You can-
can throw your hands up, you can beat the clock, yeah. You can move a mountain, you can break rocks,
you can be a master, don't wait for luck, dedicate yourself and you gon' find yourself.
Standing in the Hall of Fame, yeah.
Look who's here, Brian McTavish, to talk about some good stuff to do on your weekend, and welcome back, how are you?
Question number one.
Which is?
Did you ever dunk a basketball?
No. Wanted to, desperately.
Did you?
Never could.
Okay, now ask me.
Did you?
Was I ever desperate? That was the question. No?
Yeah, you
no.
You dunked.
No, never.
You're 6'7".
I'm a tall man.
You couldn't dunk?
I was a tall kid. You gotta wanna, and you gotta be kind of encouraged, and I think it helps to be on a basketball team in a small town, and they just make you do it.
Yeah.
I was the king of the driveway. I didn't have to dunk. I mean, you know, when you're this tall, you just lay it up and
off you went.
Get your own rebound, lay it up again, get your own rebound, lay it up again, yeah. And eventually it goes in. I was never in the Hall of Fame, but it's the 2017 National Collegiate Basketball Hall of Fame induction ceremony. There's a mouthful.
Yeah.
This year's
and what a class this is.
Oh.
Impressive.
Oh my gosh, let's go over it, shall we?
Yes.
The players are Tim Duncan. He went to Wake Forest. Of course, you know, all these guys really had great NBA careers. Cleo Hill. He went to Winston-Salem State. Scott May, Indiana. Rick Mount, Purdue.
The undefeated team of Bobby Knight back in the 70s.
It's really something. Paul Silas. Creighton, boy, was he good.
Rick Mount from Purdue.
Yeah. John Stockton. Gonzaga. And, of course, just for good measure, Coach Bo Ryan, who coached at Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
My alma mater.
Really? In Wisconsin, Platteville. Anyway, I dare you, Steve, to wear a ref's jersey at your own risk Sunday night, 7:30 Sunday at Arvest Bank Theater at the Midland. All these great players and this one great coach are going to tell their stories, and they will be inspirational, I am sure.
Okay.
Bicycle, bicycle, bicycle.
I want to ride my
bicycle.
Let's talk about bicycles. What are we talking about here?
Well, a nod to Queen.
Yeah.
The great song, Bicycle Race by Queen.
Right.
Might get performed on Saturday night at Helzberg Hall at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts when the Kansas City Symphony plays Queen's Greatest Hits. But unfortunately, that's sold out. So unless you're holding tickets to that, that's a highly anticipated show. But you can still get on your Queen-inspired bike if you'd like, by participating or cheering on riders at Cranksgiving KC 2017. It's the annual cycling event that invites bikers to get cranking and collecting and transporting and delivering as many groceries as their bicycle can carry for ultimate donation to the St. Peter Social Services Food Pantry. It all happens Saturday between the hours of 12:30 and 6 at St. Peter's Catholic Church, 815 East Meyer Boulevard in KCMO. And even if you're not a rider, bring food. Bring your own food. Donate it. It'll go to the pantry and you can take part. The public is invited. Everyone can take part in the Cranksgiving KC beer and chili feed after party.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 moving things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org. What do we have here?
The alluring, the strangely...
Cindy Wilson.
Strangely weird Cindy Wilson. Weirder than ever, yet somewhat familiar sounding, because she is, of course, one of the co-founding New Wave members of the B-52s.
I did not know this.
Back in another lifetime. It was just last month that we were talking about the B-52s during this very same time slot.
Were we?
They were at the... that's right.
Is that right?
Stay with me, Steve.
Yeah.
You can do it. Okay, so just a few weeks ago, the B-52s were at the Uptown Theater, right? But Cindy is on a solo tour, and she has this brand new album. Well, not brand new, but her latest, we'll say. It's called Change. And she has changed here. It's lush, it's psychedelic, it's throbbing, it's much more low-key, it's more trance-inducing. I think of another tune that she might throw in from the B-52s when she does her solo thing on Friday at 8 o'clock at the Riot Room. That's Friday. I'll be there. I think I'll be there, 8 o'clock at the Riot Room.
All right.
She might throw in a B-52s track, which kind of could squeeze into this guise of hers. Do you remember Girl from Ipanema Goes to Greenland, Steve?
No, I do not.
That's right. But you can have that memory for the first time Friday night at the Riot Room. Cindy Wilson. This is a bit under the radar, but you can do it. We can be there. It can happen.
He floats through the air with the greatest of ease, the daring young man on the flying trapeze. His movements are graceful, all the girls he displeases.
Let's talk trapeze, let's talk circus.
It's the Shrine Circus.
Wow.
Tonight through Sunday at the Silverstein Eye Center's Arena in Independence.
I didn't know the circus was still around. I guess Byron and Bailey's gone away, but the Shriners are still here.
Hey, the door is open.
Wow.
The spotlight is empty. It's time for the traditional circus appeal of the Shriner activity to step right in. It's a wonderful opportunity for the whole family to gasp in awe at the daring aerialists, gasp at the hijinks of the clowns, and of course, Steve, as I always do at these events, gasp for breath while inhaling way too much cotton candy. What's
yes.
your favorite color of cotton candy, Steve?
Don't do cotton candy.
Pink.
No.
If it's not pink, it's not cotton candy.
Okay.
Blue is for, I don't even want to get into it.
Yes.
Pink, all the way.
I appreciate that opinion.
It's mine.
Talk trains.
You know, I could just bob my head endlessly to that closing theme song to the old 1960s
Petticoat
television
Junction.
Series. You said it, Petticoat Junction. But I guess I have to talk about this right now, don't I? Okay, it's the Great Train Show.
I like them. I like
Did you get a train? I'm full of questions today. Did you get a train set as a kid?
Here's my story. My parents got me a train set when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
They had the track all set up. They ran it around the track once. It picked up all the lint from the carpet. They didn't put a mat underneath the tracks. And the train went kaput, and that was all there was to it. One lap around the track, and it was done.
I had no idea.
It was a little bit traumatic.
Were you crushed?
You've raised a sensitive issue with me here.
Well, we weren't rich enough to have carpet in our home. We just had a linoleum basement floor. I did have a small train set. Anyway,
we were so wealthy, yeah.
Yes, well, anyway, better than me, apparently. But Saturday, Sunday, 10 to 4, KCI Expo Center, experienced model train maniacs as well as novice mini choo-choo fans. Go. It's, I mean, lots of setups and demos and workshops and a little kiddie train for the kids. Sorry, Dad. No room for you. Saturday, Sunday, KCI Expo Center, Great Train
That's
Show.
Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thanks, buddy.
You know it.
Follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Coming up on the program tomorrow, veteran John Musgrave, recently featured in Ken Burns' Vietnam documentary on PBS. He'll be here and share his memories with us. Denny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.